Hey, BA fam, this episode is sponsored by State Farm. Are you a small business owner looking for insurance that fits your needs and budget? Look no further than State Farm. State Farm agents are not just insurance providers, they're also small business owners who live and work right here in your community. They understand the unique challenges of running and protecting a small business. When it comes to small business insurance, State Farm knows what it takes. Create a plan that fits your needs and your budget. State Farm agents are ready to help you choose personalized policies that truly understand your business. Insure your small business with a fellow small business owner. Talk to a State Farm agent today and get started on personalized small business insurance that fits your needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today. We have a really exciting guest tonight.
We do. One of our faves.
I'm about to buzz her in. She just pinged me. So we are bringing Miss Lynette Calfani-Cox back. We had her. She was like one of our, was she our first guest?
I really think she was.
That's amazing. So Lynette's back on the show. You guys, if you don't know Lynette Calfani-Cox, where have you been?
I know.
She's like one of the sweetest, nicest human beings on the planet, but she's also a money expert in her own right.
Yep.
She was a long time. Oh, go ahead.
She's like all the stuff that me, Mandy, Patrice, Tanya, Marsha, like all of these money girls that you love so dearly. She is the fairy godmother to all of us. Like she set the stage for all that we're doing and continues to help us like as we work through this journey of like being financial educators. So Lynette is the truth.
Absolutely. And if you don't know, her website is askthemoneycoach.com. Lynette is a multi-hyphenate, but she has all sorts of books. She's sort of an expert in saving up for college and has great tips for parents trying to manage the cost of college and all that comes with it and retirement. And every Monday she does a live Facebook chat. So you should go follow her on Facebook, Lynette Calfani-Cox. Check out her Monday Money Talks. Did I mess that up? I think that's what she calls them.
I think so.
I'll clear it up when we get on the phone. But we're so excited. So today I asked Lynette to come on. I think last time we talked about, I forget what we talked about, but this time I wanted her to come on and talk about a subject near and dear to, I think, both of our hearts, which is negotiating and like how to ask for more at the office and or wherever you are in your career. This is a question that we get lots and lots and lots from you guys. So stick around. Lynette Calfani-Cox is coming up.
Lynette Calfani-Cox, she was our very first interview, and she's back. So we're super excited because Lynette's going to talk about all things negotiating. We're also going to squeeze some college tips and info because Lynette got her daughter a helped her daughter get not only a free ride, but tons of money for college. So if you want to be like that, you know, get on board. Take a listen. Jamal, you listening? Good. All right. So Jamal is who we call our, we have a few handful of male listeners and that's what we call them.
Yep.
I know. They tune out for the girl stuff, but back in. But no, I think that this topic, thank you, Lynette, for joining us again. You are a fave. So this is a topic I'll never get tired of talking about, but, and I always like to get your perspective, like each person we talk to, their perspective on this. Because we still get a lot of questions about, you know, what are some strategies? How should I be asking for more at work? What do I do if I feel stuck at work and I don't feel like I'm getting paid enough and the, you know, opportunities for growth just aren't there? And I wonder if you maybe you could start off by talking a little bit about sometimes early in your career or even recently when you feel like you either have missed an opportunity to negotiate or took advantage of one and like what you learned from that?
Sure. Well, over the course of my career, I've been super lucky in the sense that I don't even know how or like why I chose to like negotiate so early in my career, because honestly, I don't ever remember my mom telling me, I don't remember any female mentors or older women telling me to negotiate. I have five sisters. Three of them are older than I am. But honestly, I don't remember them telling me to negotiate early in my career. I just kind of took it upon myself to do it. And I am so enormously grateful that I did, because it really has been kind of one of those benchmark areas in terms of my own financial life, not just as an employee, but even now as an entrepreneur. And so there have been times when I have not negotiated, and it's usually when I get an offer that's like excellent sort of right out the box, and I'm like, all right, don't be greedy, girl, you know.
But how do you know when it's when it's good enough? One of my younger cousins asked me that. She's like, I don't know, I'm really excited, but I don't know if should I just negotiate because everyone tells me to, or how do I know if it's good enough?
See, that's a great question, and you really should know, quote unquote, what's good enough for you. So I'll give you a case in point, since you asked about my early professional career, my history then. The reason I say you should know is you should know like what amount of money would make you happy and what amount of money is commensurate with the skills and the background and the value that you're going to bring to an organization. So, for example, when I got out of grad school at USC in Los Angeles, it was 1993. And I had gotten married very young, and then I moved to Philadelphia. My ex was in graduate school, and so I was working not one, but two jobs. So I worked at the Philadelphia Inquirer as a correspondent by day, and I worked at Fox, the 10 o'clock news, by night. And I was a writer and an assistant producer at Fox. So for both of my jobs, literally, I was, you know, working myself to the bone. I would be at the Inky, as we called it, for, you know, from about 9 o'clock in the morning to about 5:30, almost 6. And then I would race like a mad woman across the bridge and come back in, because I worked in South Jersey and in the Cherry Hill Bureau for the Inquirer. And then I would rush to come back over to downtown Philly area. And then I would go to my job at the 10 o'clock news, and I would get there about 6:30-ish. And be there until 11, till the show ended. Long story short, when I changed and left those two jobs to go work for Dow Jones, you know, the parent company of the Wall Street Journal, the job offer that I got from Dow Jones was more than I was making for both of those previous two jobs put together, but I still negotiated for more. So I knew at the time that not only was I going to have one heck of a commute, because I was commuting on Amtrak from Philadelphia, from 30th Street Penn Station to New York now, to go to the World Financial Center, which is where the headquarters for Dow Jones was. I knew that that was going to be 2 hours, you know, door to door commute each way. I knew I was going to have like a $400 or something round trip Amtrak ticket and everything. But I also knew, and again, I don't even know how I knew this, but I knew that it was incumbent upon me to show my prospective employer what great things I was going to do for Dow Jones and how I was going to deliver value for them and why I was worth X amount. And at the time, it might have been like, you know, $48,000 or $50,000. I can't remember exactly what it was, to be honest with you. But it was more for sure than I was making at those two jobs combined. I want to say it was in the high 40s or something like that. And another thing that dawned on me was that it's not the employer's, you know, responsibility or even concern, frankly, to worry about the fact that I had a 4 hour commute, you know, to and from when you took 2 hours each way, or that my Amtrak ticket was, you know, $400 something at the time. I negotiated from a position of strength, not from a position of need or greed. And I think that's one of the biggest mistakes that people make when they say, well, I don't know if this is a good amount. How much should I ask for, et cetera? You have to think about the value that you're going to give to a company and what is that worth? And also, what is the dollar amount that you'd be happy with? So somebody can tell you, oh, you should negotiate for more. But if you say, I'm looking for a job and, you know, to get this new position, wow, if they made me an offer of, you know, $75,000 a year, woohoo, I'd be jumping through the, you know, jumping up and down for joy. And if they come through with, say, an $80,000 offer and you're like, woohoo, I'm over the moon. Do you need to negotiate? No, you don't need to. Obviously, you'd be happy or satisfied. Perhaps you might want the experience of negotiating, and that can actually be helpful and beneficial. And yeah, you might actually get more, but it's not a situation where it's a matter that has to be forced, where you wouldn't be happy and truly incentivized and motivated to do a very, very good job.
Go ahead. I'm sorry, Mandy.
Nope. Actually, Tiff, did you move locations?
No, I'm in the same space.
Oh, okay. It's just really echoey, but yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, well, how do you, so my little sister just called me the other day. She had a job interview, and it was strange in that her employer is based in London. And so they were asking, you know, they want basically her, I guess, to pay her health insurance out of pocket, but they wanted to include that into her income. So she was asking me, like, well, how do I know, you know, health insurance as well as her her retirement package. So she was asking about how do I negotiate that part of my salary, because, you know, she never had to do that before, because usually it comes with the company figuring out the dollar amount. So what is something that somebody that she could, I mean, she's already, since I told her to go to like Policy Genius to see how much insurance would cost that she was going to be paying out of pocket. But like, what are some tips that someone who has to figure out, okay, this company's not giving me health insurance or a retirement package, how can you incorporate that into negotiating for how much you want as far as your salary?
So great question. And it's definitely an atypical situation, Tiff, that your sister is dealing with. Mm-hmm. Usually it's the other way around. Usually it's a company trying to perhaps give a lower cash portion of the compensation. And they're trying to say, but look at all these other benefits and perks. You know, we're going to take care of your health insurance. We're going to give you retirement benefits or profit sharing or stock options or whatever. So what you advise her to do is actually was smart counsel, which is you need to understand exactly how much you would have to pay independently on your own for those types of things. In general, though, regardless of which way it goes, if you have to pay it or if the employer is covering those things for you, one of the things that I teach people, and you guys know that I have a course now called The Art of Negotiating for Women on Money Coach University, I talk about valuing other variables. And it's so important to do this because for the most part, when you think about your pay, it's not just about the cash dollars that the employer is going to give to you, you know, every 2 weeks or whatever. All of those other variables, all of those other benefits, those are real life dollars, because otherwise it would be out of pocket costs for you. So you need to say, how much holiday pay am I going to get? How much extra or anticipated vacation pay will this employer be providing me? And how much negotiating room is there for that? It's always negotiable. Everything is negotiable. Will they be willing to pay off my student loans, for example, all or a portion of the student loans? Will they provide me with flexible work schedules? You know, what is that worth to me? When I was leaving, when I was at the tail end of my employment as a Wall Street Journal reporter for CNBC, one of the things that I negotiated at the end of my contract there, I had a very nice six-figure salary, but I was in the process of writing my first book. And long story short, we were at an impasse, and I had an agent who was negotiating for me, a very high-profile TV and book agent, a guy named Bob Barnett. But long story short, we were at an impasse, and at that point, I negotiated directly with a woman who was one of the key people there, and in the end, it kind of all fell apart, and there was, you know, some frankly bad faith negotiations that took place, not on the part of CNBC management and not on, you know, Wall Street Journal folks. You know, this person got fired and a whole bunch of other stuff, as did I, you know, me and 200 other people. But I'm saying all that to say that what I negotiated was when we got to an impasse and she told me, this is as high as I can possibly go. I said, okay, I'd be willing to accept that salary if I get that salary and I'm able to work 4 days a week instead of 5 days a week. And having that flexible schedule was beneficial to me. It basically meant I was working 80% of the time instead of 100% of the time, but I still got the same level of pay. And I used that extra Friday off each week to write my first book, Investing Success. So you have to be able to quantify, and you can do it through a variety of means, but you should know, for something like that, a flexible work schedule, what would it be worth to you? Only you can answer that question. You don't need to go on a website or to, you know, look up something on Google or whatever. You know what that is sort of worth to you from a quality of life standpoint or from an aspirational standpoint, if it frees you up to do something else, right?
I have a question, Lynette. Mm-hmm. So this is, and you talked about asking for a semi part-time schedule, a day off a week to work on your book. Do you feel like that is maybe treated differently than when, so for example, let's say a new mother may not get very much maternity leave at her office. Do you think it's looked at differently if a worker or woman would want to take off or ask for a part-time schedule to spend time with her newborn or with her child? And do you suggest that, you know, new moms ask for that, especially if they don't get a very generous, which many, many women don't get a very generous maternity leave schedule?
The reality is there are gender biases in the workforce. And yes, I would be less than honest if I said that I didn't think many employers, frankly, dependent upon the industry, dependent upon the line of work that the woman was doing. If I didn't say that, many employers would look kind of askance at that or see that in potentially a negative light. You have to think about it in a bigger context, however, because not everybody, of course, you know, many of us are going to have kids, and I've had three kids, and many people will go through a phase where you're out of the workforce for X amount of time. Again, I'll tell you what I negotiated during my maternity leave and elsewhere. It was great. I got an office built in my house twice, not once, but twice when I had my two kids when I was in corporate America. So it actually worked out for me. But some employers will look at what is the reason that you're asking for a flexible schedule. For example, if you want to do a sabbatical, if you want to take time off to travel or do research, if you want to go do a graduate program or take part-time for school, if you want to write a book, if you want to do something quote-unquote professional or something that's along the line of career or perhaps academic development, chances are they're going to look at that in a certain light, which is going to likely be viewed differently than taking care of your personal needs. You know, tending to your family, your kid, that kind of thing. Now, you and I, we all know that a woman or a man who is not distracted at work, who feels focused and who has flex time, et cetera, is probably going to be actually a better employee, right? Because they're going to be less stressed about it. They're going to have more work-life balance and they won't have the same stress around those issues. But, you know, think about a woman who's, you know, on the sort of on the career track to become a partner in a law firm, et cetera. Sure, I can see her being, you know, put on, quote unquote, the mommy track and not being viewed as viable a candidate for promotion, et cetera. If she flat out said, listen, I want to take time off because I want to go, you know, with my kids. I think a better strategy is to come at an employer by explaining how a flex schedule or a co-working schedule with you and another person who might be, you know, the two of you might each do 20 hours a week or something to that effect, how that would benefit the employer. Period. End of story. Again, my initial advice is that people go to employers with the wrong approach or with the wrong messaging. So that sounds like a personal need to me. You know, I have a baby and I want to spend extra quote unquote time with my baby. I took this 6 weeks maternity, 3 weeks, 8 weeks, whatever it was you took. Oh, but now I want to spend extra, quote unquote, time with the baby. That's not the right approach. Because again, that's arguing from a standpoint of need or sometimes people argue from a point of greed even, and not from a position of strength. If you can show your employer, if you can demonstrate to them how you are going to be just as productive during your 20 to 25 hours, or how you will still effective in your job, or how you will actually impact their bottom line, whether that's revenues or profits or ability to engage with and retain clients, whether it's achieving some cost savings or efficiencies, whether it's in the operation side, whatever. And you can and should be able to demonstrate that. So part of what I like to tell people about is we've all heard this expression about, oh, you know your worth, you know, and all of that. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not important to just know your worth. It's important to show your worth, to demonstrate, to literally give them a bottom line, give them some numbers, because that's what employers understand. They understand, oh, she will still have X number of customers served. She will be just as effective on the sales or distribution or the marketing side, or, you know, her efforts will help us to curb these legal costs, or, you know, that kind of thing. You have to be able to document and show to an employer how it is that you're still helping the bottom line and indeed improving it.
That's great advice.
Tiff, Manny? Do you have a question?
Oh, yeah. I was like, wait, I didn't want to do the double dutch. You know, you're like, wait. Well, okay. So I'm going to ask for the entrepreneur side, because, you know, I know that you've answered some great questions for when you have a job. So say you're an entrepreneur, and I know I've asked you this personally. You've guided me so well. When you're negotiating, you know, like a speaking engagement or a contract, and you're not quite sure, because, you know, a speaking engagement can run anywhere from, you get $500, some people get $50,000. And how do you know, what your cutoff is? Like, you know, well, I'm at a point now, I'm not going to take less than this, but I probably should not expect $50,000. Like, how do you navigate, you know? So this is someone who's not brand new to speaking, but they're also not a super seasoned veteran. Most people fall somewhere in the middle. How do you right. start to decide, you know, like, you know, how much to expect and when? Because there's been times when people have said yes so quickly, and I'm like, oh, man. You know? And I find out later,
exactly.
maybe, you know, thousands of dollars more. And I'm like, how was I supposed to know that? You know? Right. So how do you figure that out?
So great question, Tiffany. I think the way that I've navigated this challenge over the course of my career, and especially the last 15 years as an entrepreneur, is I set my rates accordingly, first and foremost, based on the value that I bring to an organization and what I would be happy to be paid to get for a speaking engagement or for other types of client work that I do. So for me, the first question is one of value. The second thing is around benchmarking. So yes, I mean, you do want to have competitive pricing, right? So that means that you do have to kind of know the going range. And as you said, somebody might be starting out. They might be like, great, if I get $500, $1,000 for a speaking gig, I'm great. I'm good. I'm real happy with that. In my case, I think a third point of reference is instructive. It's definitely helped me. And that's to talk about this stuff. That's to be candid and honest. So, for example, I pride myself on pricing integrity, and that's okay. what I call it, in the sense that any client who calls me up, they're going to get the same price. It can be Walmart or Prudential or, you know, Capital One or anybody else. I'm going to tell, or it can be Joe's Auto Body down the street. Or it can be a local nonprofit or a national nonprofit or a regional. I'm going to tell them all the same price. Now, do I have pricing flexibility? Yes. Will I be willing to negotiate? Absolutely. But in general, for me, I set my prices according to the value, where I think I am in the competitive landscape, and the fact that I do want to speak. I want to be active and out there speaking, and I like to be out there active speaking, and based on me sort of knowing kind of, you know, going rates. So I'm very upfront in telling companies and even my peers like you guys, here's my rate. This is not a hypothetical. This is the truth. My rate is $12,500 for a corporate speaking engagement. And my clients know that they have me. So if they want me to do a keynote address or a workshop or a seminar, I don't parachute in and out. I try to stay and be social and sign books and do meet and greets and, you know, that kind of thing. For nonprofits, I discount my pricing by 50%. So my price to nonprofits is $6,250. I priced it that way knowing that many nonprofits, frankly, will not have the budget. However, they will have sponsorship, a corporate backer, or I will have a corporate sponsor that's willing to come to the table. And I also know that there's flexibility, which is one of the great things as an entrepreneur. You can package certain things. So somebody might say, okay, but if we bought books also, would you be willing to come down a little on your speaking fees? Yes, absolutely, I will. If it's a local engagement, would I accept less as opposed to me going and flying, you know, and taking 2 days away? Yes, I will. So we definitely indicate flexibility in our pricing. But I'll tell you, I'll give you a case in point. Toyota, for example. So I've done some work with Toyota, and they support a number of nonprofit efforts. So I did some work with them about a month or two ago. With a nonprofit, I said, Toyota itself was the entity that came to me, and they said, oh, we're sponsoring this nonprofit. And I said, I tell you what, I know you're supporting this nonprofit. I typically charge $12,500 for corporate speaking engagements. I know you're doing this for the nonprofit. I'm going to charge you my nonprofit rate, $6,250. They said, no problem. They paid the $6,250. Great client. And, you know, it was great. They came back to me recently and they said, we have something else we want to do in October. And here's the event. And at the event, it is something out of state. You know, here's the event. And we want you to do two workshops. And we want you to do this and that, right? So I said, not a problem. It is something that they're sponsoring also for a major nonprofit. I quoted them my normal. I said, I can give you this. I can do the two workshops for this day. I'll be out of state and you cover the travel and all of that. And they also asked about books because one of the presentations I'm doing is for adults and another one is for children. So we gave them just a straight quote. We said, here, the rate is $12,500. And here, for these books, here's another price. And it was like, I don't know, $2,500 for books for here and another $2,500 or so for books for the kids' books. And they just said, yes. So now, did I say, oh, darn, I should have asked for more? No, I was extremely happy to, you know, to lock that in. And I'm very happy with that pricing. I'll do that all day long, you know, I'll be on the road once a week, you know. But so for me, I also know that companies appreciate when you not only deliver value, but when you are sensitive to their budget. But at the same time, you're giving them so much out, you know, that they probably wouldn't get elsewhere. So for me as an entrepreneur, almost all of my clients are long-term clients. They come back again and again and again, especially, and this may surprise you, Tiff, especially when I say no.
Wow. Okay.
So part of the issue for us as entrepreneurs, we think that, and a no isn't, for me, a no might be, it could be for a whole host of reasons. Sometimes it could be because there's a conflict of interest. I have another client in the space or category. Sometimes it could be, it's not exactly the right fit. Sometimes it could be a timing question. Sometimes I could be booked already traveling. Obviously, on occasion, we have a difference of opinion on money. And I'm saying, you know, this is the price that I'm looking for. And they're saying, oh, here's where we are. And if we can't have a meeting of the mind or some sort of, you know, in the middle, it's like no harm, no foul. You know, we'll get together when the time is right. And, you know, honestly, Earl and I, we have an internal saying. We say pay now or pay later.
Either way, you're going to pay, really, right?
I mean, and honestly, I almost every single client comes back. So I, you know, you don't burn bridges. You don't, you know, pull a diva routine and go off or anything like that, obviously. But it's sometimes it's not the right timing, or they don't have it in the budget. And if you say, I can't really see my way clear to perform these services or to do that for X budget, if it's, you know, beneath a number that's acceptable to you, then I don't think you should do it, because there's a huge opportunity cost. There's always opportunity cost. That deal that you say yes to, you know, for half your rate or whatever the rate that would have been satisfactory to you, that's when you're going to get another client calling for something that same time. And you're going to be like, oh, darn, you know. And obviously, you never want to break an engagement if you've, you know, kind of signed on the dotted line there. So I don't know. I hope that helps somewhat, though, to think about those who are entrepreneurs, who are looking at, you know, ways to negotiate. Again, I always negotiate from a position of strength, and I it's not a take it or leave it style. It's not that. That's not what I mean by a position of strength. I mean with a documented, proven track record.
Okay.
I mean by showing my clients, here, this is what you can expect if you work with me. So, you know, we have everything from case studies, literally, that we show, and they're like, oh, wow, you know. So they're like, you can do this with us? Yes. So it's almost like pre-packaged for them to give them a heightened sense of security and a knowledge around what to expect. Because I like to manage expectations properly, and then I like to exceed those expectations. So that's whether I'm doing a speaking engagement or spokesperson work, or I'm writing content or doing some videos for somebody or whatever.
Mm-hmm. No, thank you for that. Because honestly, it provides a lot. Well, you always provide me with a lot of clarity when it comes to, you know, what to ask for and, you know, what I deserve. It's hard sometimes because you don't even know. Sometimes I don't even know what I deserve, you know, and sometimes I feel like I overshoot. And then sometimes I know I undershoot. You're like, where do I land? And it'll be crazy because, you know, someone will come to me one day and say, hey, I've got $500 honorarium. And I'm like, what? And then the next day a client will say, I have $10,000 for you. So it's right. This weird, you're like, why am I still getting offers of $500? And not that say $10,000 happens often, but when it does, you're like, is this where I should be now? So it's definitely, for entrepreneurs, it's definitely not an easy road.
Can I tell you one other thing, Tiffany? And I kid you not, you know, I give everybody the same advice, and, you know, people take it for what it's worth or use it and don't use it, whichever. I can tell you beyond a shadow of a doubt. It's almost like, consider this my boyfriend rule. Okay.
Okay.
How you allow yourself to be treated is exactly how you'll get treated.
Okay.
So if you, with corporate clients, if you sort of say, this is my price, this is my expectation, and you kind of stand firm on your pricing, not to say that you won't ever be flexible on your pricing, but if you know for sure, I'm just not doing no $500 speaking gigs. And for me, I know I'm not going to do no $500 speaking gigs. I can say that unequivocally. It's going to take a couple $1,000s to get me out the door, period. Okay. However, but what I will do is I will try to over-deliver or be flexible in for some things, especially if I say, huh, I see some great opportunity here. I see some potential upsells or some other ways to kind of make this work. I had a nonprofit client for discretion for the client. I won't reveal who the client is, but for this purpose. But a nonprofit client recently, I went to New York, which is, you know, a 40-minute drive. I just, you know, left my house in New Jersey to New York. It's a nonprofit. I was paid $4,000 to do basically an employee event, and great organization. And they've already said, okay, when can we have you back? You know, and because it's a national organization and they have interest in other things, digital financial education for their employees, I saw a bigger opportunity there. So again, sometimes you get, you know, you might be a little more flexible to think about, you do want to think about long term. So that matters a lot too, I think. But for the most part, if you just have sort of a rate sheet, or if you have a set price and you say, here's the price, you know, what happens is the people who can't play in your sphere, who aren't ready and who don't have the budget, they go away. And believe it or not, word gets around. And that's a good thing. You want word to get around. So in the African-American community, in the nonprofit space, in the college market, in the government market, in different arenas, in some women-owned sort of spaces, for a time, you know, some people were like, oh, you know, don't reach out to Lynette because, you know, she might be X price. And it's not that I'm going to say no, like, no, I'm, you know, oh, you're beneath me, I can't come on and do something with you. Absolutely not. It's the opposite. It's me saying, let's make this a bang up, you know, presentation and event for your constituents, your employees, your customers, your prospects, whatever, right? And here are my ideas. This is what I can bring to the table. And here's the price for that. This is what this is going to get you. Sometimes they were like, great, let's do it. You know, sometimes they say, oh, this is what our budget can accommodate. And we negotiate a little bit and it, you know, works out. Other times it's like, nope, we just don't have that at all. And if it's a platform or an organization that we think, huh, we could develop something here, I may go to one of my corporate partners or to another third party to try to make a three-way deal happen. And those are also lucrative and creative opportunities. So it doesn't have to be a no, a hard no. I always say that a no is sort of just not yet, especially okay. when you're negotiating. But, you know, kind of setting a benchmark or like just an absolute minimum, like really, I'm not coming out the door for this. I'm just going to, you know, and just knowing at least internally what that number is for you. Okay. It really is important because you can just put all the other stuff. You can just like let that stuff go away or redirect it or help educate your clients too, to say, you know, here's where my pricing is X. Because I feel like I know in the industry for personal finance experts, what I do, like I know that say a Gene Chatsky is going to charge more than me. I know a Susie Orman definitely is going to charge more than me. So, but then I know that my pricing is going to be more than many, many, many other people who aren't at, you know, at their level. Right. But for me, 12.5 is perfectly comfortable. I'm just, you know, it's, I don't feel that it's overpriced or underpriced. I feel that it's right about right for me.
I think that is such a great piece of advice for anyone, whether you're an entrepreneur or negotiating a salary in the corporate world, because I have certainly felt like people walk into a negotiation and have no idea what even to ask for. They just feel like, I got to negotiate and I want a lot of money, but I don't know what the number is. And if you have to, I mean, it's as simple as like, what does it cost you to live and what will it cost you to be, you know, happy? And I think you should have that number in mind when you go in. And then either way, when you walk out, you at least know that you went in educated and you went in having a number and knowing what you want, and you know when to be happy and when not to be happy with an offer.
And honestly, when it comes to negotiating, again, one of my other principal lessons is bring your A game. You absolutely cannot bring your A game. You can't be your best. You aren't being your best if you don't have a number in mind when you're going to an employer, because frankly, it's telling me that you've been lazy, you've lacked discipline, or you've lacked initiative because you haven't done the bare basics in terms of research. There is absolutely no reason, with all of the information and knowledge that's at our fingertips today, for you to go into a negotiation and say, well, I don't even know, like, how much is this job paying? Or, you know, what's the person who's already in the job or the predecessor in this position, how much do they get paid? Or others in the industry, what do they get paid? There's just way too many sources of information for you to get that information. You know, that data. You can go to Glassdoor, you can go to salary.com, obviously Indeed, you can use Payscale, and you can find out, even the government, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, okay? You can find out based on all kinds of information, literally down to a specific company, what pay scales are in a company. based on title and industry, based on years of experience. You can always find out about a given range for salary for a specific position. And you really should go into the door of a negotiation, whether you're trying to get hired or even get promoted on a job. You should absolutely know that information. If you don't, it's telling me you haven't brought your A game. You haven't done enough homework yet. Even just talking to, you know, HR managers, employees, and other colleagues, even if not at that specific company, but at other competitors who are in the same job and getting a feel for salary. You can and should do that.
Hey, BA fam. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors. That's incredible. This is according to Indeed data and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Leveraging over 150 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Okay, it's smart. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/brownambition. Just go to Indeed.com/brownambition right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/brownambition. Terms and conditions apply. You need to hire. You need Indeed.
Okay, guys. So as you know, you can, anytime you want, ask us all of your money and career questions. And thank you to those who have been emailing us. If you want to share a question with us or you have a question, head to brownambitionpodcast.com and click on the Ask Us Anything tab. Or you can go directly to the source and email us at brownambitionpodcast@gmail.com. So today we have a question specifically for our illustrious guest, Miss Lynette. Lynette, you still there?
I am indeed.
You ready? Okay. Because this one is exactly right up your alley. So as we know, it's graduation season is still underway, I feel like, in a lot of the country. People are graduating and going to college, and a lot of parents are like, oh my God, what do I do? College costs have never been higher. There's not much you can do. You know, honestly, let me start this over because this question I forgot is about a mom of a one-year-old.
That's okay.
I was about to say there's nothing.
Well, you
can
segue. There's not much you could do if your teen is like 17.
But I was thinking, I'm sure Lynette has some tips for them.
I got them all.
I know. I'm not trying to undercut your abilities here. All right, let me start over. So as you know, it is college graduation season, and there's a lot of new parents out there who have young kids and are worried and stressed out, looking at the cost of college going higher and higher every year. And so today's question is right up Miss Lynette's alley. You have how many books on higher education costs?
Three.
No.
Actually, four, sort of, because another one was like a spinoff, a little thin book, but. College Secrets for Teens, and Zero Debt for College Grads. And then I have a spinoff called Free Pre-College Programs. So,
and by the way, your daughter, you have two kids now in college, and your daughter went to school with how much, like 200,000 or plus in scholarships, or was it even more than that?
So how much time do we have?
Okay. a lot of money, you guys. She knows what she's talking about. So let's get to this question. Actually, I can share my interview I did with Lynette at Yahoo.
What
was it, 1 or 2 years ago? I can't remember.
Yeah. I really want to tell your audience though about that whole thing. And just so let me answer your question. And then if we have time, you let me know and then I'll share some, because I actually have learned more since in the 2 years that my daughter's been in college. So go ahead, ask your question.
Awesome. This shouldn't take too long, but this is a question I feel like will strike a chord with a lot of young parents out there. It's from listener Megan. She says, I'm a single mom of a one-year-old and I'm trying to get financially literate so I can provide for her and prepare for retirement. One of my greatest concerns is saving for her college education. Can you discuss ways to start early in saving for college? I've heard of 529 college planning investments, and I'm not sure whether it's worth it. I haven't met anyone who's done it or is doing it and has found it worth it. I'd greatly appreciate any insight you can shed on this topic.
Okay, so first of all, hello, she's met me now because I've done it. 529 plans for all three of my kids, and they work. They're a fabulous way to save for college. And the gist of it is that a 529 plan is a state-sponsored college savings plan. It is something that is portable, meaning your kid can use it across, you know, any accredited school, any higher education institution in the country. It's transferable. So let's say, you know, this listener only has a one-year-old right now, but let's say her one-year-old grows up and says, ah, mom, I changed my mind. I don't want to go to college. Then, but she had another baby down the road. If she had funds in the first child's name for the benefit of that child, then the money could be transferred to the other child. The parent herself could even use the funds in a 529 plan and go back to school and use it for higher education expenses. And it's actually advantageous in the financial aid process. So because a 529 plan is for the benefit of the student, the money is still retained from a financial aid standpoint in the donor's name. In other words, it's considered an asset of the parent. It's not considered a child's asset. So that's actually helpful when it comes time to getting financial aid and free money for college, because schools and the way the whole FAFSA system works, the FAFSA being the free application for federal student aid, once you fill that out, they determine what's your EFC, or your expected family contribution. And in a nutshell, any assets in the student's name, the student is expected to contribute roughly 20% of that, of those assets. So let's say there was, just to use a round number, $1,000 in a 529 plan. That's considered something that's in the parent's name, and only 5% of that is expected to be contributed overall when they're looking at the parents' assets in their totality. So if the student had, say, $1,000 in his or her name, just in a checking account or in a savings account, $200 out of that would be deemed necessary to be turned over as part of the expected family contribution. So long story short, 529 plans are great. They work very well, especially if you have a young child and you're gearing up to start saving. You can save a little bit at a time, and it really can grow over time. There's a website that's very helpful as well. It's called savingforcollege.com. Savingforcollege.com. It's run by a guy named Joe Hurley, one of the premier 529 experts in the country. It'll teach you everything you want to know about 529 plans, and you can get them in any state. And some of them, some states even offer tax advantages for opening a 529 plan.
So when you had your three plans for your kids, did they each have their own, or did you just open one and then you sort of like let the water fall over after each kid went to school?
They each have their own 529 plan, and you do have to designate who's the beneficiary in effect, who the account is for the benefit of. In my case, for example, my kids had a New York plan, and it's not the case. I've never lived in New York. I'm not a resident of New York. At the time, we just picked the New York plan based on a host of factors that we saw at the time. But you don't have to live in a specific state. Like, you can get the Utah plan or the Minnesota plan or the Florida plan. Each state plan is managed by a fund manager, typically a company that sort of oversees the assets and the investment process and directs how the monies that are put into a 529 plan, how they're directed. But you do have choice and flexibility about that, about which plan you can go with. And that's why I referenced that site, Saving for College, because they actually show you, they give you performance rankings for different states and whatnot.
Okay, so I do want to get into your story because it's so extraordinary, and yes. I'm excited to hear that you know even more about it than you did 2 years ago.
Okay, so that's why I asked, how much time do you have?
So tell me, start off with your daughter, and then I know you have a son, you just started college, right? Or is going to be starting college, and talk about how you sent your daughter to school with far more money than was necessary to cover the cost of college.
Okay, so the reason I asked you how much time do you have is I like to tell these stories in their entirety, and I like to revisit them because, frankly, there's always good, bad, and ugly, and excellent, you know, in any sort of financial decision or any kind of process like this. And paying for college obviously is a process. So here's my family's story to date. So my daughter Aziza is 19 years old. She just finished her second year at the University of Texas at Austin. My son is 17. He's going into his senior year of high school. So he has one more year and then he'll be going off to college. I have a third child, Alexis, my 11-year-old. But Aziza, long story short, was one of those just outstanding, over-the-top kids. She was a National Merit Scholar. She speaks French. She was the president of the French club in high school. She's founded a multicultural club. She had like a 2230 SAT score. She was an A student. She did all these amazing things, volunteer work, drama girl, theater club, blah, blah, blah. So she was one of those off-the-charts kids. She was sought after. She got accepted to a lot of great schools, and she won a boatload of merit-based scholarships, not need-based scholarships. There's two types of scholarships you can get: need-based, based on your family's income and assets, and merit-based, which is based on the student's accomplishments in some ways, typically academic, athletic, artistic, or social engagement, like volunteer work, community service, etc. Okay? So my daughter had a lot of academic accomplishments and artistic accomplishments. She won, really in total, over $750,000 worth of scholarships.
Whoa.
Yeah. So now you have to understand, this was from the schools that the vast majority of the aid that she was offered was through the colleges and universities themselves. And so that's one of the things that I teach people is, if you're looking to get scholarship money, the biggest dollars come not from private sources, third-party sources. You could, of course, win a Gates scholarship, a Coca-Cola scholarship, et cetera. Very competitive, obviously, for those scholarships. But the schools themselves, colleges and universities themselves, are the biggest source of money directly to for merit-based aid, okay? So she got, for example, at NYU, she won the MLK scholarship. You know, they were giving her $50,000 a year. At my alma mater at USC in Los Angeles, she won a presidential scholarship, and that was going to be like $27,000 a year. She got accepted to Fordham. She won a National Merit Scholarship there, $48,000 a year, blah, 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 on and on. Ultimately, she turned those down, of course, and she went to UT Austin. She got accepted into their business honors program, and she won about $40,000 roughly worth of scholarship aid to pretty much cover most of her college costs. We only had to cover like maybe $5,000, you know, some, you know, the books, you know, the travel back and forth, the, you know, some, a little bit of the housing, stuff like that. But she won a lot of scholarship money directly from the school itself, including a $10,000 a year scholarship from BHP, the Business Honors Program. And the best thing was an out-of-state tuition waiver that she got, which was almost $30,000, as a result of winning that $10,000 scholarship. The two were tied together. Okay. Now let's fast forward. My child, my A student, my national merit winning child, had a horrible first semester.
Aww.
Yeah. So,
we've all been there.
Telling all up on her business, and she doesn't mind. She really doesn't. So her scholarship was dependent upon her maintaining a 3.5 GPA or better, and okay. she did not. So her first semester was horrible. Her second semester she bounced back. I was like, what has happened to you? You better get those grades up, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and she did, she recovered. And then her second year, which was, had just passed, she did well again, did great. But bottom line, because she did not have at the end of her first year, overall, she did not have a 3.5 GPA. She lost her scholarship.
Oh my goodness.
Ouch. Yeah. Forever? Or could
forever? I know, right? I'm like, what?
Are you talking about probation or?
Yeah. So she was on probation after her first semester. Then she was off after one semester, and she, okay. Like I said, she bounced back. She was fine, but that wasn't the issue. The issue was, sorry, girl, we said 3.5 or higher, and you don't have overall. She didn't have a 3.5. So even if she had not had a horrible, if she had had a 3.49, pretty much, they would have been like, sorry, it has to be 3.5 or better, you know? So it's been a learning experience. It taught us a couple of things. One was about transition. I don't know if I shared this with you before, and I'm sure I didn't. My daughter in her senior year of high school, a couple months before graduation, she suffered sudden hearing loss in her right ear.
No, I didn't know that.
That impacted her, you know, a little bit, her first semester in college. She was sick for 3 weeks and, you know, she didn't tell me. And I was like, you didn't go to like the campus health? She was like, I didn't know how to do, you know, on her own the first time. I think there was transition issues. Her going from, you know, East Coast to the South, basically Texas, that transition, being raised in a bubble, admittedly, you know, in the suburbs here. Mountainside, New Jersey, population mm-hmm. 8,000, and then going on a campus with 50,000 students alone on the campus, you know. Yeah. So I think there was a lot of transition, and it was just a little overwhelming for her, everything. So, but got back, you know, right back up on the horse. I told her, don't prove it to me, prove it to yourself. Go back up there and show me what you can do. Show yourself, even more importantly. And she did. And so I'm fast forwarding to say, as her parents, we did something that I'm sure some parents would be like, what? We actually doubled down on Aziza. We put a game plan together. And I said, if you need any tutoring, you're going to be talking to your academic advisor and your counselors. You're going to do this, this, that. She did everything I asked her to do. Her grades went back up. She got A's and B's. And there's no problems. However, because we had a financial situation now that we had to say, okay, what are we going to do here? School there is about $55,000 a year, you know, all in tuition fees, you know, room and board as an out-of-state student. So cutting to the chase, this is what we did. We bought her a condo. Now, some people would be like, what? Like, what?
I'm trying to follow, but I'm hanging in there. Okay.
So the short explanation is that her having a condo, ownership of a condo for 1 year establishes Texas residency for her. So instead of us having, you know, a $38,000 or $40,000 a year tuition bill, she gets now, she'll be getting in this in her junior year, in-state tuition of about $11,000.
Wow.
And the housing side is covered because we put down, you know, $21,000 or so, $25,000 to buy the place for her. She has two roommates. The roommates pay $1,400 a month. The mortgage is $1,400 a month. So there's no net sort of out-of-pocket cost for us with that. And her housing is covered with that. So it actually, you know, thank you, Jesus, it worked out. That's actually how we dealt with it. And, you know, now she's getting back and she's applying for scholarships again. And, you know, part of the lesson is if you lose a scholarship, you know, mercifully for her, she had parents who had the financial wherewithal to backstop her. Because, you know, I can tell you, you know, her father, my ex, was like, oh, well, I guess you got to come back home. And I was like, no.
But she still had to pay for out-of-state tuition, right, for that semester?
For her sophomore year.
Did you guys finance that with student loans or?
We had to just pay it. We had to pay. Ouch. So,
You know, that's something similar happened to my little brother. And UT is a state school, right?
Yep.
So their merit-based aid comes out of state funding, correct? Or is it like a private endowment?
No, it's a public school. So they do have some scholarships that they award through private donors that give them, you know, give students their scholarships. But if you're a resident, that's coming through if you get state aid, that's through the state of Texas.
Right. One thing that happened to my brother as far as losing his scholarship, we went to the University of Georgia, big state school. And he had a merit-based aid, but since the recession, when college funding has sort of dried up in a lot of ways in state-funded schools, because states have been, you know, in some cases divesting, there's less money to go around. So the same scholarship that I got for maintaining a 3.2, I think, GPA, he had to maintain like a 3.7 or something, and he lost it.
And can I tell you something, you guys? I'm telling you, this is, I hate to say it this way, I won't call it a racket, but I will say that colleges and universities across the country employ specialists and professionals that are called enrollment managers or yield managers. They actually know that a pretty high percentage of students are simply not going to maintain those grades, thus the high performance bar. So it's preparing me with my son, because I know that based on our family's income and assets, it's not likely that we will qualify for need-based aid. I will still apply. I will still go through the FAFSA process, just like I did with Aziza. But when I think about scholarship opportunities and any potential free money for college for him, for my son, I'm looking at merit aid and institutions that do grant merit aid, or schools that have very, very strong need-based aid. And those are mostly the Ivy's top, you know, sort of elite private schools and those with strong endowments. But these schools know. They absolutely, I believe me, when I went through this experience with Aziza, I did an exhaustive amount of research. And I was like, oh, this is not actually uncommon. Can I tell you something that one factoid that says it, you know, clearer than anything else that I came across? The average high school student suffers a 0.5 drop in their GPA when they go from senior year of high school, 12th grade that is, to their freshman year in college. So in other words, the student who had a 3.85, let's say, GPA, on average, that student will have a 3.35 or a 0.5 drop in their GPA. That's just nationwide the average.
Okay.
So you might be like, oh, my child is so smart and bright and they'll be great. They'll be fine. Yep. They're gonna be able to maintain. I was like 3.5. Oh, Aziza's got this. No problem. You know? And so, but obviously it's next level. It's a higher tier of performance that's required of the students. Not to mention, it's not even so much the academics and the grades that are, you know, oh, this is so hard. It's more about all of the stuff that they have to deal with being on their own for the first time. The transition for many students, financial definitely plays a role for a lot of students if they're stressed or if they're worried about it. My daughter, she wasn't stressed or worried about money at all. It wasn't that kind of thing. But everything else in her life, she had to give attention and focus to, I think was, sort of a factor for her. But these schools absolutely know. So now I know with my son, oh, you can believe I'm going to negotiate the other way. When they say, a 3.5, here's his scholarship, blah, blah, blah. It's dependent on him having a 3.5. I'm gonna be like, he'll come to your school. How about a 3.0? How about,
I like that.
I'm serious. I'm absolutely going to negotiate. And I've talked to parents since who have, in fact, negotiated and gotten that bar down a little bit. Or I've even talked to parents who said that they had a provision as long as the student is making, quote, satisfactory academic progress. So you can read that. It means no GPA requirement. As long as they got a 2.0 or better, basically, at the end of a given year, in case they have a little blip one semester. So, you know, I think back to my college days, my freshman year, I was fine. It wasn't then, but it was either the end of my sophomore year. I did some kookiness and, you know, just running wild. And I was like, ooh, let me get it together here before I get kicked out of this school.
Junior year.
That was yours?
Me. Yeah, that was me having breakdowns in the parking deck. Yeah. After the career fair.
Mine was freshman year. My father brought my behind right back home because I was not used to, because I was raised in a really strict household. And so living on campus was like, what?
Overstimulation, overfreedom.
The thing is, I was not really wild. It was just like, I could stay up late because my dad, especially my dad was the type to be like, where are you going? Put the name on the refrigerator. I'm going to call the parent ahead of time. I'm going to drop you off. I'll drive you to the movie. So I was not used to any freedom.
Yeah.
And so it was just too much. And I had always gotten really good grades. And I think I got my first D and he could not believe I had gotten a D.
I know.
Like, you're not about this life.
Yeah. He's like, yeah, no. Well, this is funny. When my daughter was, I can't remember if it was her 16th birthday. It's possible it could have been her 15th birthday. Now, again, remind you, I live in a very tiny little town, 8,000 population. Suburbia is, basically about, it's 97% white. It has, some diversity, African-American, Asian, et cetera. And it's a small place that is also a safe place. So when my daughter turned, I think it was when she was 16, I said, oh, what would you like for your birthday, Aziza? She said, oh, I'm going to give it some thought. And then she came back to me and she said, okay, mommy, I thought about it. And I said, great. What would you like? She said, just a little freedom. And I was like, well, freedom, freedom to do what? She said, just like to walk around the block by myself.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh my God, Lynette, girl, I used to be running the streets in LA. Okay. We used to run outside and come in when the lights came on. Okay. I mean, it's a whole different ballgame, even though, my child is in a very safe environment here. The bubble that we're in is crazy. So I think that she had the same experience, Tiffany, that you did, which is like, oh my God, I'm free. Nobody tells me what to do. And nobody's on me, making me go to bed at a certain time, double checking my homework. It was just transition to young adulthood.
Lynette, thank you so, so much. Tell the people where they can find you and find all your great work.
Sure. They can catch me on my free financial advice blog, askthemoneycoach.com, or they can take a course with me and get video training, one-on-one lessons through my platform on moneycoachuniversity.com. Free and paid offerings there.
Awesome. Thank you, Lynette. You're always the best.
Thank you, guys.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.